This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Let's go straight to our first caller, and it's Alan in South Ryde. I bet this is Alan Palmer.
It is, Boris. How are you, mate?
Alan, how are you? Nice to talk to you.
Is this your voter?
This must be one of my... Well, I don't know whether Alan was one of my voters, but...
6,000 members in our group.
Yes.
We've been trying to speak to you for months and months, but when we try and contact you, we have to go through layers and layers.
Oh, I'm very sorry, Alan. Well, I'm delighted to
no layers here, Alan.
No layers here. This is as direct as
straight to the organ grinder.
Gets. I must say, I found your trail was everywhere I went in South Ryslip, and I met many of your supporters and your group, and obviously I'm familiar with some of the questions that you've been quite rightly putting.
What is it you want to know from Mayor Johnson, Alan?
I want to know how people like me and people I represent, there's nearly 6,000 of us now.
Yes.
This time next year we'll be 16,000. How do we contact you when we have
okay.
a problem?
Well, Alan...
So when he says people like him, Mr. Mayor...
I'll tell you what's going on. Alan is a public-spirited guy in South Ryde, who I've been expecting to meet him, actually, on the stump, and I've met lots of people who are with him. And what they are talking about is a burglary spate that I think that I'm going to... Alan, you must correct me if I get this wrong, but essentially what happened was there was a burglary spate in the South Ryslip and area.
500 in 4 months.
That's right. And there was a spike largely caused, we think, by people coming into the borough from outside. It's a familiar problem in that part of London. You'll know in Barnet and Brentley that you have a long-standing problem with people coming in from outside London and being responsible for burglaries. Alan, what following the representations that your group made to me, I got on to the borough commander and indeed to the Met generally, and we had a long conversation about burglary in the area. And actually, you know, they perfectly accept that there was a spike. They perfectly understand the reasons for your concern, and they applaud your actions. They assure me that they've got it under control. Indeed, the figures that I've seen suggest that it has been coming down quite substantially.
But what
I would like to say is, obviously, in future, I would very much welcome, you know, much more contact with you and your group. And the way to get in touch is go to Wayne Bridges, talk to Wayne Bridges at the council. We will fix up. I'm going to have a surgery very shortly. You know, come and see me at the earliest opportunity. I think before the end of the month we can definitely make sure that you and I have a meeting in Uxbridge.
Can I just ask you one quick thing?
Yeah, of course.
We had a presentation for Lionel Lake, a World War II veteran on Saturday, who was robbed in his care home, 91-year-old. We raised over £5,000 for him.
Yes.
Any thought on that kind of crime in this area?
Well, I think it's absolutely disgraceful, and obviously, it's sickening that World War II veterans should be treated in that way. And I know it will be no consolation to anybody listening, let alone to the veteran concerned, but that sort of crime really is coming down fast, and we will obviously one thing that we are doing in Uxbridge is celebrating the historic contribution of that area to victory in the Second World War.
Ah.
And there's a great plan afoot, as you may know, Alan, to create a visitor centre. You know, have you been to the great war, the bunker underneath RAF Uxbridge?
Yep, yep.
I mean, that is an extraordinary place, and it's only really recently come to public view because of it was an active unit until 2010. But it is a superb place to go and remember. That was where Keith Park, Winston Churchill, everybody was responsible for controlling what happened in the Battle of Britain. And I'm very pleased that George Osborne is going to be putting some of the LIBOR money into creating a new visitor centre there as well.
Right.
That's you know, just by way of saying what we're doing to celebrate veterans of the Second World War.
Now, Mr. Mayor, Alan, thank you for your call and good luck for all the endeavours and indeed to that presentation that you mentioned. You said you're going to have a surgery very, very soon. How soon?
In the next couple of weeks. I can't give you the date yet. We're fixing it at the moment.
Right.
But I can tell you this, Alan, I will be having surgeries even more frequently than my illustrious predecessor, Sir John Randall, and he did an outstanding job. He had surgeries, I think, about once a month. I will do it much more frequently than that.
All right, I think.
And I think the trick that all of us have got to to learn as new MPs, and obviously it's a while since I've been in the in the House, is it has changed. I think it is important.
What do you mean by it has changed?
The job is now much more intensive as a in terms of representing your constituents. I think I was pretty effective in Henley and South Oxfordshire. I really did get dug in there. But I think people now expect a very good service from their MPs, and they judge them at the end of 5 years on what they've delivered and what they've attracted.
Is that because there's more media?
I think it is.
Inspection of you blokes and women. What is it?
I think it's possibly that. I think it's that people, people are more. Perhaps it is social media. It's things like Alan Palmer's group.
Right.
They are more aware of what MPs are up to or not up to. And I think sort of the old days when a kind of Tory MP could sit and luxuriate in a majority, or Labour MP, as you've seen in Scotland, could sit and luxuriate in a multi thousand majority and expect to be. That's all gone. You've got to get out there.
Alan, and we go to other callers, Mr. Mayor. Where are we going next?
We're going to Mary in Finchley.
Okay. Mary. You're through to the Mayor. Go ahead, Mary.
Hello, am I through to the Mayor or am I through to the new Member of Parliament?
You're through to both, Mary.
You're through to both.
I incarnate both in one object,
exactly
one human being.
Yes. Because I think there is a clear conflict of interest.
Uh-huh.
Between being a mayor for the whole of London and a member for part of London.
All right.
Because you're also only doing a part-time job, and I presume you're getting a proper salary from both positions.
No, well, can I clear up several things there? The first is actually to be an MP as well as mayor. Actually, I take an abatement of my mayoral salary. I do not get you cannot get two salaries at once. And under
I can't actually hear you.
You don't, Mary, get two salaries at once. And so I've had a cut in the mayoral salary.
How much?
I can't give you the figures, but there's an abatement to reflect the fact.
How much did you make as mayor?
It's all in a matter of public record.
Well, no, how much? You must know what salary you make.
Go and look it up.
Is it £120,000?
It's of that.
You don't actually know what you earn. It's
of that order.
You actually don't know what you earn.
I don't feel disposed to discuss my salary.
Right, I'm going to give you a figure of £140,000.
It's been reduced, I think, to take account of the fact that you can't.
£143,000 is
you
what
can't, you can't know, have. You
dear,
can't have
how
two
much
jobs.
Have you got in the bank that you don't know what you earn?
You can't have two jobs.
Right.
You can't have two salaries. And so, Mary. So the first point. The first point, Mary. The first point.
Was
Mary
an MP makes 66.
And the second. The second.
Right,
the second.
Roughly?
The second. Yeah.
He's only doing part time for both. And how can he give full time to?
Okay. Well, let me answer that, because that's a serious and a substantive point. And the answer there is actually there are large numbers of people in government who serve constituencies very well and who have very large spending departments. And I might point out that Ian Duncan Smith has just been reappointed as Secretary of State for DWP. He's got a budget of, I don't know, £130 billion, and he sits for a London seat. You've got Therese Villiers, who represents Northern Ireland.
What was that, Mary? You don't want Mary?
Well, I didn't want to just discuss money because I don't.
You did start it on money. Respectfully,
it's about the executive job that you have to do, and there is no reason at all. I mean, to stop someone, the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, the various other people who have big executive jobs from representing their constituents extremely well, and that is what I will be doing for a year. As well, I'm member of Parliament for Uxbridge and South Ryde, as well as mayor. And
Nick, it was a conflict of interest that I really wanted to say.
Well, come on, let's. What's the conflict? Because that I really don't see. I think there's an integrity. There's an alignment of interests in the sense that actually what I'm able to do is to represent the people of Uxbridge and South Ryde very well indeed. I mean, I've represented them already for 7 years and. I don't, as London mayor, of course. I'm not entirely certain.
So, lastly, lay out precisely where you think suddenly Uxbridge is going to get more cash than Finchley or wherever else it might be, or Bexley.
I see what Mary is.
Is that what your concern is?
No, it isn't. What I'm saying is that a conflict of interest...
Well, I don't understand.
Well, because his constituents want to know he's acting for them. But it might be that as mayor, he might be for or against something that is adverse or better off.
I understand. So what you're saying, Mary, is that, for instance,
Heathrow Airport,
or HS2. Important.
You can start with that.
Which is very important in West London, and people are extremely agitated. Or Heathrow. Mm. People are extremely agitated about the impact of HS2, Mary, on their back gardens, on their lives, the
air quality,
the spoil from the tunnels, and all the air quality. So they will be. I will be representing the people of Uxbridge to try to ensure that damage is minimised.
But yourself.
But that was what I was doing anyway.
Yeah, but let's take the airport.
If you take the airport,
you're no fan of Heathrow.
If you take the airport, I'm a great fan of Heathrow.
No, sorry, Heathrow.
Thank you. That's a very important distinction.
Yep. Okay.
I'm a great fan.
You would
of
lie
Heathrow
down
airport.
In front of the bulldozers.
I'm an admirer of John Holland Kay and the way he's leading it, and I think they're doing a good job. I just think, and I've got to be realistic about this. I just think that the prospect of expanding Heathrow and putting in a third runway and then a fourth runway, because John is very, very clear that that's what they want, are virtually nil.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Can we go to Alex in Felton?
Looking over there.
Hello, Mr. Jones.
Alex, how are you?
Hello. I was wondering, Mr. Jones, what is your response to the Saturday protests against the austerity and the recent election of the Conservative government and also the media's coverage of it?
Well, Alex, the truth is I saw a little bit of the media coverage. I saw the desecration of a war memorial, which I thought was absolutely atrocious.
The role by women played in the war.
And I thought that was unforgivable. I hope that charges will be brought against those who did that. But for the rest, Alex, I'm afraid, you know, we have protests in London. We have 5,000 protests in London a year of one kind or another. Some of them are violent. Some of them are more aggressive than others. Any kind of violent protest is to be strongly resisted, and you can count on the police to do their job.
Last point from you on Alex. On that, Alex, do you want to say something else?
Well, it was mostly peaceful, and the media, I noticed, made no mention of the poetry, the songs, the music, the dancing that was there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. Well, I'm sorry to miss the poetry. Was there a good poem that perhaps our listeners could hear?
There was a few poems. I'm sorry, I can't remember it. I'm pretty sure it was spontaneous and improvised on the spot.
Yeah, right. Often the best.
Even a 12-year-old girl that spoke out against David Cameron.
Okay.
I just think, as mayor, you should be aware of these things. Given that police were filming non-stop, I think you should have probably evidence of these poems and this 12-year-old.
Well, thank you very much for drawing that to my attention. And, you know, if there is a... Perhaps if you could bring... I'll be on again soon, so bring back the poem. Let's hear that. I love poetry. I don't think we have enough poetry in our society, in this country. I love public readings of poetry.
I think it was an anti-David Cameron poem.
Was it? I'm sure it can't have been. It wasn't obscene, though, was it, Alex?
Very polite poem.
But was it a very anti-Cameron?
It was against austerity, and I believe the Metropolitan Police have it all on camera.
Okay, well, I think a recitation, Alex, by you of that poem, I think will be.
Alex, talk to one of the team. If we can book you in for the next Ask Boris, we'll have you read the poem.
Can we get Peter in West Hampstead?
Yes, after this. Can I do an email?
Yes.
Just David in Ealing. The recent idea for the tube seating, please could you tell the mayor, on a trip on the Central Line, I've noticed all the armrests have been removed. This is madness, and it makes it impossible for the elderly or the disabled to stand when leaving the train. There's no armrest to grip, just the obvious error of grabbing the next passenger's knee. This is balmy, just to provide an extra seat per row.
Right. Okay, well, this is encouraging undesired over-familiarity between passengers as they leave the... as they get up. I will find
are you,
out...
Were you aware of this?
I'm not aware of this, actually, of the removal of
the
armrest.
Why the heck have you done this?
Well, I mean, if you look at the S-Stock trains that we've got, the wonderful new...
Are those the ones that never end?
They're
pretty cool, actually.
They're wonderful, yeah. and they are much more capacious, and it may be, and that's because of the sheer volume of passengers we have to cope with. And I think
are they operating on the Central Line?
They're not. No. So I'll have to get into the.
Okay.
And the answer will almost certainly
be the old stock on the Central.
It is the old stock, and by the way, we will be replacing them. But I think what it may be, and I'm improvising here, and I'll have to get a proper answer.
Unlike you.
Yeah. Come off it. The answer is almost certainly to do with capacity. And trying to make sure we can get more people on. And what it shows is the vital importance of continued investment in the tube.
Right.
You know, we're going to be going now. If London is going to be going.
But you don't want strangers grabbing each other's knees on the tube by mistake, do you?
No, of course not. No. We want to maintain normal British decorum and reserve.
At all times.
As we disembark. But the issue is whether people feel cramped, whether people... are comfortable. So I will get onto it, and find out why we're doing it. But it's almost certainly because we are the sheer weight of numbers we have at the moment.
Ray in Mottingham, congratulations on your party's victory. One of the main reasons for me voting Conservative was the Tory policy on the right to buy housing association properties. When will this be brought in? Asks Ray.
I imagine that this will come in as soon as we can get the legislation through, and we now have a majority. And we will be doing that. I just want to stress that one crucial point that I think Conservatives have got to make now, in all humility to the country, is we understand that there were millions and millions of people who, Alex has already referred to the demonstrations. There were millions of people who don't agree with absolutely everything we're saying. There are millions of people who do feel that austerity was a mistake. I don't happen to think that they're right. I think that the policies pursued by the Conservatives were essential for the strength of the economic recovery, which actually benefits everybody. But we have to take account of that feeling, and we've got to proceed. We've got to make sure that all our policies are articulated, so that people understand how they will benefit absolutely everybody in society, and the lowest paid people above all. And it is very important. There should be no unnecessary triumphalism now. Just because we've got a Conservative majority, I don't think people want to see, and I'm sure this is true of Tory MPs, they don't want to see any sort of, as I say, hubris now. This is a moment for humility, for trying to deliver a programme that will really benefit the whole country.
We go to other callers. You mentioned Peter earlier, yes.
Peter.
Go ahead, Peter.
Hello, am I on?
You are, Peter. Go ahead.
Boris, it takes 30,000... voters to get a Tory MP, 40,000 to get a Labour, quarter of a million a Lib Dem, over a million for a Green, and 4 million for a UKIP. Now, simple yes or no answer. Is this, in your opinion, fair? And if you believe it isn't, what should be done about
it? Well, we should be immediately, Peter, in my view, rectifying the injustice that was was perpetrated by the Liberal Democrats in the last Parliament, who refused to go ahead with boundary reform. And
Will make it possible for UKIP to get 4 million and get more than one MP, will it?
And that partly addresses the problem.
Really?
What it doesn't do is introduce wholesale proportional.
Well, let's get Peter in on that. Peter, are you satisfied?
Peter, we had a referendum on that. Go on, sorry.
Am I on?
You are, yes, Peter. Go ahead.
Boris is talking absolute rubbish. It's just complete nonsense. This is why people are turning away from politics. Yeah. They can't get straight answers to straight questions.
I gave you a straight answer. I said I thought we should have boundary reform. There you go. If you don't want that answer, then put in your pipe and smoke it. That's what I'm saying.
It's a little bit offensive, isn't it?
No, it isn't.
The point he's making is virtually 4 million people voted UKIP, 3.9, and they get one MP. You're telling me that boundary reform will lever that all up?
Well, no, I'm not saying that.
Precisely. Peter's point.
He said 30,
is it fair?
Peter began by saying...
Is it fair?
30,000 to elect a Tory...
Mr. Mayor, is it fair, Peter's question. His central point, is it fair?
What is certainly the case...
No. Is it fair?
No, it's not.
If you agree it's not fair, what are you going to do about it?
We had a referendum the alternative vote system, which was...
But you agree that it's unfair with the caller?
Which issue was massively deliberated.
You,
do you remember it?
I do remember it.
Does Peter remember it?
Peter, come back in.
Yes, I do remember.
Which way did you vote, Peter?
The selected method was ridiculously stupid.
Which way did you vote then?
Sorry, I voted in favour of reform, but the method you chose, AV2, is a ridiculously stupid method. Why did you choose AV2? You pulled the wool over.
I don't think I'm,
you have to forgive me, but I wasn't actually responsible.
But if you agree that this current system is unfair,
I think it was Nick Clegg and the.
Trust you to speak with someone who's not here to defend himself.
Well, okay. Right.
If you agree the previous system was unfair, how will you make the system fairer?
Well, as I said, one way to make the system a bit fairer is to go for boundary reform.
Right. There are 4 million, virtually 4 million Britons who feel utterly disenfranchised.
Well, we've had a referendum on PR, on proportional representation, in very recent memory, and it was overturned. It is quite a big thing, or it was not successful. It is quite a big thing to have yet another change to the constitution, an important change to the constitution. I appreciate that people feel, and people like Peter feel.
So we carry on with the unfairness.
There haven't been enough seats for the party they support, but that is the way we do it. No one is pretending that any electoral system is perfect. We had a long series of arguments about whether to go for AV.
Not right, though, is that you carry on with something you know, to your use your own words, is unfair.
All systems of electing representatives have some defect or other. There is an unfairness in the number of voters who vote for minor parties and don't feel that they get enough representation in Parliament. But then if you go for a strict PR system, you produce other imbalances in the system. Right. And you've got to take account of that.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Ask Boris with London Mayor Boris Johnson and, of course, Uxbridge Conservative MP Boris Johnson as well. Now, Mr. Mayor, one event that's happened in London that's perhaps the coverage has been a little bit lost because of the election coverage is involving a teenager called Henry Hicks
and claims
that have emerged earlier this month. He was stopped and searched by police once a week in the 3 years running up to his death. Yes. He was 18. He lived in Angel in London. He was subjected, it is claimed, to at least 156 searches over that period, say his family. What is this?
It's a tragic case. This is a young guy called Henry Hicks who died in the course of what seems to have been a chase involving the police. And I've met his parents. I met his father, certainly, and I think various other members of his family, who are obviously in a state of deep grief. And there's a large groundswell of public support for the family and a really, really strong desire to get to the bottom of what happened and to hold the police to account. And clearly, I share that. And I've asked the commissioner and the top of the Met to see what they can do to, accelerate matters. But obviously, it is now in the hands of the IPCC. They've got to be the Independent Police Complaints Commission. They've got to get on and...
But this is something that's staying on your blotter. You're not going to let this go.
We're not going to let this go. And I just want to reassure people who are campaigning for the Henry Hicks and for his memory and that we will be chasing this down. And there will be, we expect, I think, a preliminary report in June, then further reports in September. Obviously, the CPS has also been looking at it.
All right. Commiserations to any of his family and friends who may be listening. One other policing matter before we go to other calls. This comes in from Patrice. Now that Theresa May is in her old position and Boris Johnson is there too, what's going to happen to the water cannon?
Well, I expect that they will. The water cannon will stay in where they are. I hope very much that they will not ever be used.
They can't be used at the moment.
And let's hope they're never used. Let's hope they're never used because...
So you won't be seeking to lobby the Home Secretary to permit their deployment?
As I have said to you many times on this show, if, and I hope devoutly that will never happen, if there were to be circumstances in which...
No, but they can't be used at the moment.
If there were to be circumstances in which it might be necessary to use a water cannon, so there was a serious risk of life, there were riots that were threatening buildings and property and human life, then I think it would be, there's no doubt that a license for a water cannon would be readily procured.
How readily?
Readily. Speedily.
What does that mean? Because
quickly.
Had she licensed them, All it would require was, I would imagine, for the Commissioner of the Metro London Police to authorise their deployment.
We don't, look, let's
now, he's got to ring you, you've got to ring her.
You seem to have a lust to deploy these things. You do. You want them used.
I'd have them out at the drop of a hat. Yeah.
Why? Well, I think that's... I don't think...
I'm not the Commissioner of the Metro London Police. You might have noticed this.
And he doesn't... Neither he nor I share that.
So what's the point of having them?
Because, as I've always said, they are there. You know, you might say, what's the point of having Trident? You know, they're there as a...
No, but at least Trident could be legally deployed. You can't use these things.
And so could these in...
Once they've been authorised.
Once they've been authorised.
Why did Theresa May write to every chief of police in the land seeking reasons not to use these water cannons?
Well, I think, obviously, it's a... she quite rightly regards it as a very serious and matter that needs to be properly discussed and thought about.
Had you known then what you know now about water cannon, would you have purchased them?
Yes, because I don't think the facts have changed. I think with the
was it £400,000?
We took a decision that the...
How much was it?
I think it was slightly south of that from memory, but...
How much was it? So you don't know how much the water cannon was?
I think it was more like £300,000, but I will check the figures for you.
So what's in £100,000?
The advantage of having them, obviously, is that in the last resort, the police felt that they were something that they might want to call upon. And I tell you, now, I think many of our listeners will think, thinking back to the riots, thinking back to what happened in Croydon, to the inability of the police then to control damage to property that was really grievous, I think they will think it right that the police should have, in the final resort, access to such utensils of crowd control. Now, they are far less violent, as I never tire of telling you, than either baton round police charges, which the police are already legally entitled to use. It's a medium range tool of crowd control. And there we are. Right. Let's see what happens.
Okay. Daniel
in West Hampton?
That's absolutely right. Daniel, go ahead. Daniel, you're on the radio.
Daniel.
Morning, Mr. London, and good morning, Boris.
Well
thank
said.
You. Good
well
morning.
Said,
well, it's all right. No, well, you never know, Daniel. You may be prophetic in what you say.
We shall see. On we go with the question.
Go on.
Morning. Yeah, thank you. Mr. Mayor, my question is about the cycle superhighway scheme.
Yes.
You know, I understand it's been given the go-ahead for the two major cycle superhighway schemes, east to west and north to south.
Yes.
Now, the traffic already, when the roadworks have started already, the traffic already along the major arterial routes, along the river, down by the embankment,
Yes, I heard. You heard the traffic report just now blaming the congestion on the cycle superhighway. LBC continuing their vendetta.
Yeah.
But they're quite right.
As a London motorist.
So it is right. Hold on. It is right. You agree that this is causing.
I do agree. Let Daniel ask his question.
Yeah, the point I'd just like to make, Mr. Mayor, I'd just like to ask you, why are you ploughing ahead with narrowing major arterial routes in London? As a Londoner, I want cleaner air in London. We need to have a cleaner London. I agree with you. But the traffic chaos it's going to cause, why are you ploughing ahead with it? It's crazy.
Well, Daniel, I perfectly accept, and Nick will doubtless come in on this now, I perfectly accept that the cycle superhighway construction is going to cause... some disruption, and there's no getting around that. I've got to shoulder that, and I've got to explain it to Londoners. The reason for it is I think it will be good for us all in the long run, and that we can continue smooth flow of traffic on both those routes once the highways are in, without significant impairment to traffic. But I think that the cause of making cycling safer is a high one, a noble one. It's right for London. We should have. We should be a great cycling city. If anything, Daniel, I wish we'd done more and done them sooner. And I hope very much that the cycling superhighway program will continue. I'm conscious that answer, won't necessarily please you, but I think it is right. We've had many deaths of cyclists in London that we've all grieved over, and we want to make it a safer, more attractive city to cycle in.
Quick response from you, Daniel, because I've got a point to make on this actually.
Yeah, I just like to say, look, I agree with the point that we need to make London better for cyclists. I agree that, but what I'm saying is it's madness. It's totally counterproductive to narrow all the major arterial roads through central London for cyclists. I mean, the scheme is crazy. I just, you know...
I think we go round and round in circles.
Well, we've been over it a million times.
There's another point
in order to try to minimise the actual damage to the...
Val in West Dulwich says, please ask the mayor about the 20-mile-hour speed limit that's being spread out over London. I live near Croxted Road in West Dulwich. The roads all the way to Crystal Palace are in the 20-mile zone. In my experience, this is dangerous. I drive a little smart car. I keep religiously to it, but other cars are not like that. Is there not a... And on the way home, a cyclist overtook me.
Right.
There is a real danger, Mr. Mayor, now, that cyclists, proficient cyclists such as yourself, although you'd never break this to me, you can easily get above 20 miles an hour. So you will have roads in London where the motor vehicles will they will have cameras, and your chums, the cyclists, will come hurtling through, breaking the speed limit, and now the lives of pedestrians will be put at risk.
Well, that is a point. And
I hope it can just come to you.
We are extremely concerned about the about cyclists cyclists colliding with pedestrians.
Yeah.
Obviously, where I'm afraid that happens. Most frequently, when cyclists mount pavements illegally, what we've been doing under Operation Safeway, and you've seen what we've got a whole new traffic command now in the police.
Safeway, it's old Superbike.
No, I know, but it's an operation that it involves fining cyclists.
Right. Well, can I suggest under Operation Price Right, we actually put discs on the back of bicycles, and then you can take their numbers if they speed, because they will be going faster than the vehicles.
Well, very few cyclists get above 20 miles an hour. I mean, that is
seriously?
That is, well...
You're telling me I couldn't get above 20 miles an hour?
Not for very long, Nick. I mean, I think...
You're telling me that I couldn't get above 20...
No, you could get above 20 miles an hour. I'm just not saying you'd sustain it for a long period. I mean, I'd be...
How long have I got to go before I hit somebody and they get hurt? I mean, I wasn't thinking of doing it for 20 miles. I've only got to come round the corner and
20 miles an hour, I'm sure you'd
there's
be...
There's Charlie
Farnsworth
coming out to collect his pension, and I got him on the handlebars.
Well, I'm sure you'd be in full control at all times, and that's what we want cyclists to be, and that's why we've got Operation Safeway to invigilate the roads and to stop them being out of control. I am fed up when I'm at the traffic lights and I see we've got huge numbers of cyclists now on the roads. Today's a fantastic day for cycling. Everybody's out cycling. You should be.
Well, I'm not.
Well, you are sometimes.
I'll be battling to get around London in my limousine today. I'll be stuck in traffic courtesy of your cycle superhighway. It'll take me forever.
I thought you were a passionate cyclist.
I have got a bicycle, but I've got things to do and things to carry and people to see and buses to catch. Right, more emails. Wendy in West Wickham, I've been aching for Boris Johnson, fortunately it does go on, to explain exactly what happened in the general election. Can I get his unfettered interpretation of how the Tories triumphed?
Yes. Well, Wendy, what happened was what I always said. And I came on this show, or perhaps it wasn't this show, but like many, many media outlets before the election, and I said the polls were grossly underestimating the massive common sense of the British people, and they were looking at the choice, and they were going to go for economic stability. And I think in the end, the prospect of having a Labour government that was going to be hobbled by the Scottish Nationalist Party was one that really alarmed people.
When you see Nicola Sturgeon, what goes through your mind?
No, I had a very nice conversation with her. We've had a long conversation with her.
Is the media depicting her a menace
I think the interesting thing is what kind of accommodation we can make, how to take things forward now, because the question we've all got to work out is, what is the real agenda of the Scottish Nationalist Party? Do they really want do they really want to break up the entire United Kingdom? Let's see, because I'm not certain that actually Scottish people who vote for the Scottish Nationalist Party in their heart of hearts want the dissolution of the entire United Kingdom. I think that they don't want rule from England. They don't want, Southerners having too much of a say in their lives. But I think they would be very distressed if things that they value, the idea of the United Kingdom, the idea of the Crown, a single spiritual entity, was somehow destroyed.
I know we've only got time for two more, and these will be emails because you have to get to cabinet meeting. It's lovely to say those words.
Well,
later this morning.
That is not true.
Oh, is it not?
No.
You've not been invited.
No, but as you know,
it's the political cabinet today, isn't it?
What I've said before is that
is it
I
not?
Can't do two jobs.
Oh, you won't be attending cabinet.
And I will be attending a political cabinet.
Yeah, that's what I said, political cabinet, yeah. And this question actually leads to that. Rachel in Bexley, how does Boris feel now? Right. He's been overtaken by David Cameron and also overtaken by his brother Joe, who at least has universities to look after, and Boris doesn't.
Well, who's asking
Rachel
this question?
In Bexley.
Is this Rachel Johnson, my sister? He's probably my sister. Rachel.
Well, she doesn't live in Bexley, I don't think, does she?
Well, she's everywhere. I think this is a typically provocative question from my sister Rachel. And the answer is that I'm very, very proud to be, and I'm very proud of my brother Joe. And obviously,
but he's got universities
to
look after.
I'm very proud of.
You're without portfolio.
Well, I mean, can I just say that what I am trying to do, and this is the crucial thing now, the message that the reason I couldn't take a job in a ministerial job now is that I have a massive executive job. Go back to Mary's question right at the beginning of the programme. I have a massive executive job in London. We've got a huge amount still to do. As I've been saying to staff in City Hall, this year in City Hall, I want us to work up to a juddering climax of effort and energy in which we deliver all the things that we need to do.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Can you be racist if you're an ethnic minority woman? A student union officer who banned white people and men from an event promoting equality has claimed she cannot be racist because she is a woman from an ethnic minority. Goldsmiths University's student union welfare and diversity officer Baha Mustafa sparked a backlash when she told white people and men they should not attend an event on diversifying the curriculum. On Facebook she wrote, "Invite loads of BME women and non-binary people. Also, if you've been invited and you're a man and or white, please don't come just cause I invited a bunch of people and hope you will be responsible enough to respect this is a BME women and non-binary event only." Other students said it was patronising and laughable. Well, here's Baha Mustafa's view in her own words.
"I, an ethnic minority woman, cannot be racist or sexist towards white men because racism and sexism describe structures of privilege based on race and gender. And therefore women of colour and minority genders cannot be racist or sexist since we do not stand to benefit from such a system. In order for our actions to have been deemed racist or sexist, the current system would have to be one which enables only people of colour and women to benefit economically and socially on such a large scale and to the systematic exclusion of white men, of white people and men, who for the past 400 years would have had to have been subjected to colonisation. We do not live in such a system."
That is Baha Mustafa, who's not available for interview. She gave a speech, went on for 7 minutes, and it drew some applause, an event at Goldsmiths in New Cross, South East London last week. At the heart of it, if you are a non-white woman, can you be racist? Let's speak with Jabir Butt, who's Deputy Chief Executive of the Race Equality Foundation. Well, can you? Good morning.
Hello, Nick. I don't think you can. I think it obviously does depend on your definition of racism. And if you use the Oxford English Dictionary, then perhaps you can. But I think our understanding of the operation of racism is that it is something about the majority exercising power over a minority. And I think in that sense, Baha is right. However, it is deeply disappointing and dispiriting that we're paying so much attention to something that's potentially quite a side issue, really, when you consider what's going on in the experience of minority communities in Britain. There are much more important things that we should be addressing, and really, I think...
It's Baha Mustafa who's decided to give this such attention by taking a rather questionable decision and telling men and non-white people they can't attend a certain event.
It demonstrates a lack of understanding on her part as to how we should then address racism and sexism. But I have to be honest, when you consider that last week the government reported a dramatic increase in the number of racist incidents impacting on minority communities, we've still got David Cameron talking about black unemployment and the fact that we've not been able to make the inroads that we should have done. So those are the things that we should be talking about, not this.
Well, we can always talk about those another day. So a group of black people cannot be racist towards a white person.
Well, in the context of Western society, racism has to have a definition, and that's that isn't just about prejudice on its own, because we're all prejudiced in some way. Racism is about the exercise of power, and the exercise of the power in this instance is about the majority against the minority.
Yeah, but I'm talking about a workplace where perhaps for the purpose of debate there are 9 black people and there are 2 non-black people. They're not being racist if they're prejudicial towards them in any way.
Well, they are prejudiced, and
I know. They're prejudicial. And racist. Are they being racist?
Everywhere, and it's the laws are quite clear.
So,
you cannot
be racist if you're black.
Well, as I said, that's the definition of racism.
No. But I'm asking you. You believe that?
Yeah.
Wow. Jabir Butt, thank you. You're Deputy Chief Executive of the Race Equality Foundation. Let's speak with June Eric Udori, who's a student, campaigning student. She's 16. She writes The New Statesman. Thank you for coming on the show. Good morning to you. Do you agree with us then? Good morning. If you're non-white, you can't be racist.
I think it's really important to look at how this story's been reported in the media, which is that Bahwa Mustafa wasn't necessarily holding an equality event. She was basically saying she was trying to create a safe space for BME women to come and talk about their experiences. And she has every single right to say, if this is about BME women talking about their experiences, and if she doesn't want to have white people present.
Ms. Eric Udori, the event was about diversifying the curriculum. It was not billed as making a safe...
No. I personally have, I've heard of Bahwa Mustafa. I've involved the threads with her. This was an event that she was holding to create a safe space for BME women on the Goldsmiths campus.
It was about diversifying the curriculum, which would be of interest to everybody, white, black, male and female.
Well, if she feels that this is a diverse...
Now, subsequently, she wanted to make it what you term a safe space. I get that. But it was initially, if you're diversifying a curriculum, it's of interest to you, whatever your colour, whatever your gender. Subsequently, she said, I would contend, that she did this to create a safe space. I don't know what she thought might happen in the university, but if you're talking about changing the curriculum, everybody deserves a say, don't they?
I haven't heard that it's about diversifying the curriculum. What I've heard is that she was gathering BME women to talk about their experiences. That is what I've heard from Bahwa Mustafa. I don't know about her putting together an event to diversify the curriculum. Well, there will be individual cases where you can have white people, black people who will be act in a racist way towards black people. But if you look at the whole thing, nothing happens in a vacuum. The people who experience racism, the people who experience are black people, people of color, the people who experience sexism on the majority basis are women. And so, yes, there can be certain instances where this can be reversed, but on the whole, this is something that affects people of color, and this is something that will affect women. And so, it's quite interesting that as soon as women of color come up and say, actually, we're going to create a space, we're going to take up space and make decisions about ourselves, everyone seems to, get a bit crazy. And at this, we shouldn't really be talking about this right now. This shouldn't be the issue. It should be that in the country we live in, women of color are significantly disadvantaged compared to their white counterparts. And that is what we should be tackling about securing equality for all.
Right. I hear what you say, but so on the whole... words you use, so you can be racist if you're non-white.
I'm not saying that you can be racist, but you can have racial prejudice to other people. But that isn't. But if you look at the
define the difference cases, between racism and racial prejudice. Racial prejudice.
Well, it's almost basically the same thing. But
so they can.
I just don't think.
I'm confused. I'm sure it's my fault. I'm not this. But are you saying that non-white people can be racist, yes or no?
There can be individual instances where this can happen, but
racist,
that isn't,
yes.
That doesn't happen in a vacuum. And actually, if we look at the statistics, the people who experience racism on a daily basis are people of color, not white people. The system that we live in, benefits those. And ultimately, we cannot benefit from a system that is against us. So, yeah, there can be instances when this happens. But, that is very, very low. And, there are very, very low instances of this, almost non-existent.
Right.
I mean, how many times do you see women being sexist towards men, and how many times do you see people of color being racist? I'm not saying it doesn't happen, because I don't know every single story. I'm sure it does happen. I'm sure there can be instances, but the majority, the thing is, women of colour experience racism, they experience sexism, and people of colour will experience this more than people of other of other races. And that is what we should be focusing on today.
And I would urge you to look at the genesis of this story, which was an event to about diversifying the curriculum, which then subsequently...
I think the media has sensationalised...
No, it's not sensationalised. Just listen to me. No, don't tell me how the media works, respectfully. A union... A student union holds a meeting about diversifying the curriculum and then decides that you can't go if you're male or you're white. That is wrong. The university itself said that it expressed concern over this.
She was trying to hold a safe space. All right, you're not going to have it. And that this happened.
No, she was not. I don't know what you don't understand about the words diversifying the curriculum. I've been around this bay four times. I'm really rather tired of going around it again. It was for all the students, I hope you understand that word, about diversifying the curriculum. It subsequently became only for women and non-white. OK, so hopefully we finally got that point through. I'm grateful for your input. June Eric Adori, you're a campaigning student, you're 16 and you write for The New Statesman.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
The times were great. It was a relationship that went far. You say it shared power. You tasted victory. You travelled around the world. And then the relationship came to an end. There was something called a general election last week, and all the dreams were shattered. And you're a Labour supporter, and you're sitting there, or driving there, or even standing there thinking, what happened to our great party? Well, you can tell Tessa. Yes, Labour Dame Tessa Jowell is here for counselling to dispense advice and wisdom by the bucket load. And I should, of course, remind you, if you're listening in London, she's also running to be the London Mayor. Dame Tessa Jowell, I know I can call you Tessa because I've known you for a couple of years now. Welcome to the studio.
Oh,
people will be ringing in seeking solace. The wound's still raw?
Yes, but you've got to pick yourself up and move on, but take very seriously what people in London have said to us, and indeed people across the country. And
well, in London, actually, you went up by about 3.4% the Labour vote, didn't you?
We did well in London, but we certainly did well in London, but we didn't do well enough.
No.
And so there are no grounds for triumphalism, but
certainly no grounds for triumphalism. Oh, I see what you mean in London. I see what you mean. Yeah.
No, but yeah. We've now got seven new Labour MPs in London, and they are all fantastic.
Mm.
And we had a brilliant campaign in London. I mean, we had 10,000 activists, not all party members, and party supporters who wanted to get involved with Labour. And I think that in that lies the basis of the strength and possibility of our recovery.
All right. You're here to take calls, to talk about Labour nationally, or, of course, to talk about Labour in London, where, as Dame Tessa rightly points out, they did actually have an uptick in support and possibly even running as mayor. First call, Andrew in Chelsea. You're through to Tessa Jowell. Go ahead, Andrew.
Good morning, Tessa.
Good morning, Andrew.
What is going to happen about the fire sale of social properties in London? We've lost about 11,000 properties in London. Housing associations are knocking down beautiful Victorian developments and replacing them with luxury flats which are being sold off overseas, some of them two-thirds empty for most of the time. And the Labour Party is doing nothing in London to stop it. And we've seen in Southwark even them building developments and contributing to the social cleansing of London.
Well, I agree with you, Andrew. I think that this is a huge problem. There are all sorts of, you know, kind of backdoor perverse incentives that have been given to developers. One I got onto just before the election, which was essentially that if developers took over an empty property, they were not bound to create affordable housing. So what was happening was that tenants were being moved out, the building taken over empty without the responsibility to provide affordable housing. I got onto that. We had a very well supported online petition, and on the last day before Parliament was dissolved for the election, the minister changed the rules. But There's no one answer to this. There's one that you have to go through all the building regulations and take out everything that is an incentive to that kind of bad behaviour. But I think also that on new social housing, we have to end discounted right to buy. You know, the fact is that the replacement rate for homes which are sold is that one home, social home, is built for every 23 that were sold. So is it any wonder that there's a housing crisis in London? Andrew, and it affects us all.
Andrew, a quick response to you. Yeah.
Yes, quickly. Come down to Chelsea. We've got an estate, a Victorian estate, the Sutton estate, which Affinity Sutton are going to sell off over 50% of it for private housing. They're going to make a profit in excess of £150 million on this. And nobody seems to care.
Andrew, I would love to come down to hear more, talk to the tenants and residents affected. So there's a date. We just need to decide exactly when.
All right, Andrew, stay on the line. One of my team will take your details and then we'll pass on your contact
details to
one of Tessa's team. And we will follow up. But I know Tessa of old. If she says she's going to do something, it will happen. You've got my word. Andrew, talk to one of the team. Thank you. Jason in Mayfair, you're through to Tessa Jow. Go ahead, Jason.
Hi, Nick. Hi, Tessa.
Hi, Jason.
I've supported the Labour Party all my life. I was so disappointed during the election. But it seems to me, since Blair, and including Blair, when some bench spokespersons for the Labour Party talking in the media, they talk like intellectual academic Marxists. Why don't you talk in terms of things like renationalising the railways? No one would object to that. Or bringing back the energy companies into public ownership. No one would object to that. You know, you missed the boat. It's almost as if you are frightened to really talk about social issues that affect everybody. You're frightened to show that you are Labour. It's not about being anti-aspirational. It's about actually saying there are certain elements of society which should be in the public domain.
Stay on the line, Jason. Let's hear from Tessa.
Well, Jason, I agree with half of that and I disagree with the other half. You know, what I agree with is the sort of founding Labour principle that we achieve more together than we do alone. And therefore, building community, building a sense of common purpose, you know, the success of many mutual businesses, all these are a practical expression of Labour principles. And in fact, I mean, in our manifesto, we did have commitments to part renationalisation of the railways and action to cap the prices of energy companies. But you see, I think there are two things here. One is that it's important that people can see in a political party that their ambitions can be realised, that there isn't a sense of, an attack on doing well, being able to provide for your children. There's not a kind of implied criticism of success. And I think some people took that from our campaign. We focused very heavily on the people who were most vulnerable, on zero-hours contracts and so forth. And it's right that the Labour Party and the trade union movement stands up for those people. But the important thing is... Well, Jason, can I just say this? I'm sorry if I'm going on a bit. But, you know, we live in a very fast-changing, globalised city, and we've got to be able to respond to all those changes. Some of the old solutions work, some of them don't.
Jason, you're on in a second, but you say that there was the Labour campaign. Come on, there was going to be a mansion tax. There were going to be tax increases. Of course it was seen as a bit of a fight on people who do well or who are aspirational, Tessa. How else could you characterise that?
Well, I think it was seen by that, about like that.
So the mansion tax was a bad idea, wasn't it?
Well, I think it's fair that people who live in very valuable properties...
Define very valuable.
Well, I mean, worth millions of pounds. Three million, four million, five million.
OK, so Ed Miliband just comes in under there.
Well let me... who live in very valuable property should pay more council tax than people who live in a property that's worth £500,000 or £600,000.
Yes.
I mean, that is
But a mansion
fair.
Tax as such...
The problem with the mansion tax is, first of all, we're not talking in London about mansions.
No.
We're talking, in many cases, about three-bedroomed terraced houses,
yes.
Point one. The second is that if you're going to announce something like a mansion tax in inverted commas, you've got to explain it very carefully. My great concern, and it goes to Jason's point, is that many people who owned houses worth £800,000 or £900,000, which is quite easy in London, actually felt that they were going to be liable for the mansion tax. They never were,
so it was
but they thought
by Labour,
they would.
Wasn't it?
Well, I don't think we explained it properly.
Yeah. Jason, you wanted to get back to Tessa Jowell.
Yeah,
Jason.
I did. Tessa, that wasn't my point. My point is, why are you, as a party, shy to talk about, you know, things such as nationalisation?
Well, no, Tessa did say that was in the manifesto, Jason.
Yeah, but they didn't make a public... thing of it. I'm not anti-aspirational at all. I'm doing very...
But let me just ask you this, Tessa, because I know you're asking for some coffee. Grab a bit of coffee while I just briefly speak with Jason. Jason, do you not think that the way the Labour played the NHS, which is a jewel in the crown in British life, it was a key concern, it does register very, very importantly on many people's list, that they perform well on the NHS at least?
Well, yes, I do, in a way, but then they should have said, look, if there is any profit to be made in the NHS, any profit, it's not going out to private tenders. If there's profit to be made in the NHS, it will go back to the NHS. This nonsense of limiting profit to private tenders of 5% just shows that they are frightened to actually be secure and confident in their political aspirations as well as...
All right, OK, I will leave that. Tessa Jowell, when Lord Mandelson says that the party lost its way in the last election campaign, how accurate is that?
I don't think the party lost its way. I think that, you know, Ed Miliband... I said this to lots of people, Nick. Ed had a very clear view of what was wrong with the country, what he thought was wrong with the country, and how he wanted to fix it. I think it wasn't that we lost its way, we lost our way. It's that the country didn't want to buy that diagnosis of what was wrong with the country and most of the solutions that we were recommending. And I think we've got to take that very seriously.
But the skill of your party under Tony Blair was that you went to the voter. Do you not feel with Ed Miliband he expected the voter to come to you?
No, I wouldn't see it like that. I think that what is... And, you know, you can't go back.
But you must learn from history.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to keep on moving forward. I think you have to stay in the centre ground and you have to build a broad coalition of support and people have to feel inspired and safe if they're going to support you.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
You are, and you won't be offended when I say this, Tessa, you're a Labour veteran. You've served in cabinet, you've served under...
I went from being a rising star to being a veteran, and I'm not sure what happened in between.
You have blossomed. You have blossomed in your career of strength, and you've been cabinet minister, you've held all sorts of important briefs. You thrived under the Blair and Brown years. How does the party heal its internal wounds now? You've seen a bit of infighting in the past.
Well, I think one of Miliband's achievements was to keep the party together. I think it was quite remarkable. But you've got to be... I think the lesson for the next stage is that you've got to be united around a really common cause, not people, in a way, just uniting for the sake of unity.
So who's the best man or woman to do that?
You mean you're asking my view on the leadership contest? I'm going to sit that one out. Because I think it's very early. I want to see how they all perform. And I hope that your listeners are going to...
But who might the Conservatives fear most?
Who might the Conservatives fear most? I think, again, it's too early to say. In another two or three months...
Andy Burnham's a smooth operator, isn't he?
He worked for me. He is a truly lovely man, Andy. Very grounded. But, you know, I think that they're
Northern,
all talented.
Good-looking, health, brief.
Absolutely.
I mean, it ticks all
lovely
boxes,
family.
Yeah.
All those. I mean, he is a really lovely man. But I'm not going to say support any of them at the moment. I think people have got to have a chance to make up their mind and see them perform. And they're not all, I don't think they're all out yet. You know, Tristram Hunt last night put on a very strong performance on Question Time. So let's see if he's going to throw his hat in the ring.
Pauline's in Watford. She's thrown her hat in the ring to ask you a question, Tessa. Pauline, go ahead.
Good morning.
Hello, Pauline.
Good morning. What can Labour do in opposition about the creeping privatisation of the NHS? I've sent you some email evidence. But particularly, shall we say, I think that advertising or negative advertising probably played a significant part in Labour's loss. Because if you repeat like a mantra ongoingly, Ed Miliband, the backstabber, his father was XYZ, if you repeat repeatedly, Labour crashed the economy. I think that the brainwashing effect is quite good. That's why people pay millions for advertising.
Yes, we didn't have millions, as many millions to spend on advertising as particularly the Tories did, Pauline. And, you know, that was probably set us at a disadvantage. But we did have thousands and thousands of people out on the doorsteps, not just in London, in Watford, across the country. And that is, you know, that's a very effective way of engaging with people.
How would you have spent the extra money? Had you had the sort of money that the Conservatives had, what would you have spent it?
I think I would have spent even more on our local organisation, and I'd have spent it.
But you had more troops field than any other
party.
Yeah,
but I think that had
the truth is, your message didn't work.
Well, our message in the end, clearly our message didn't work. But in
because you had a left-wing Marxist at the helm of the party.
No. In building the party,
if you'd had David, you'd have won, wouldn't
you've
you?
You've got look, listen, it's over. We lost the election.
You and me?
No. Oh.
Don't tell me like that,
never,
for God's sake.
Never.
If you'd had David Miliband, it would have been a different story.
We've now got to move forward. And the Labour Party is very good at looking back, wishing things were different, all the rest of it. But there's a lot of energy out there, particularly in London, to move forward and, you know, to build the kind of party again, which captures people's ambition and people feel safe to support.
Pam's in Lambeth. Go ahead, Lambeth. Pam.
Hello. Good morning.
Hello.
Pam.
Hello. I'd like to ask you a question, please, Tessa. It's confusing in Lambeth. I've just heard you praise Andrew Dismore, who sits for one of the North London boroughs. He has been a very, very strong advocate against regeneration and supporting council tenants in that area. I live in Lambeth, where I live on Cressingham Gardens, actually, where we have no support from the Labour Party in our fight for our rights in the face of regeneration. Why is there such a huge disconnect between North London, South London? Why there doesn't seem to be a Labour policy?
Well, I think the point is that both are important. Regeneration is important, Pam. You know, we've been talking already just in the last half hour about London's desperate need for new and decent homes for people. But where people are displaced, and I went to a regeneration area in Haringey the other way, where people are displaced, what's important is that care is taken to make sure that they are as satisfied with the alternative for them as is possible. You can't pretend that regeneration involves no disruption for people, but you've got to pay a lot of attention to the people who are disrupted and understand, you know, their anxieties about losing their home, moving their home. And so I think you have to be able to do those two things.
All right, a couple of emails coming in. Teresa in Hornchurch, how patronising was the pink bus?
I don't think the pink. I went out on the pink bus, and I went to Enfield North, met about 26 formers, all of whom were registered to vote, feisty, interested,
how
engaged.
How patronising was a pink bus it's for not, the ladies'
not,
vote?
Listen, we all talked about it. Isn't that the good thing in politics?
All right. Theresa's second point. Why did Labour MPs attend a public meeting with a segregated audience? This was up in Birmingham when there was a meeting arranged by a local, I think it was a Muslim Labour councillor, and the men sat on one side of the room and the women sat on the other. How wise is it of Labour to attend that?
Well, you know, I wouldn't be at all. You know, I don't think we should do that. I don't know enough about the circumstances.
If you went to a meeting, a hustings meeting, and you saw that it had been arranged by a faith, and they had women on one side and men on the other, what would you do?
I would. I think, you know, Nick, these things are much more sensitive than just saying you arrive there and say I'm not having this. I think it's the kind of thing you have to organise in advance. But I wouldn't be happy sitting in a segregated audience.
Roy's in Huddersfield. Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, hello. Good morning, Tessa.
Good morning, Roy.
I'm the son of a Labour councillor, county councillor, magistrate, football referee to boot, chairman of the schools, management, etc., and had to grin and bear him talking to me in assembly and all the others with great embarrassment.
How embarrassing was that, Roy? Eh?
When I married and moved to the first house, I became a member of the local Labour Party, and I helped out at the 79 election, which went to Margaret Thatcher, of course. Then we went all those years, and in 97, stayed up all night, May the 1st, wonderful. And then Gordon Brown's very first budget, and I remember it well.
I'm going to have to move you to the question, I'm afraid, Roy, because we've only got about a minute left.
I'm on tenterhooks here,
yeah,
Roy.
I know. You and me both.
Why is Labour not atoned for the sins in destroying public, private sector final salary schemes? They disappeared one by
pensions.
One. And they've never apologised. And they've done,
this is the claim that it was Labour that destroyed the pension schemes, Roy. Is that it? Yeah.
Absolutely.
OK, so hold on the line, Roy. Thank you. And wonderful background, true Labour credentials. Tessa Jowell.
Well, I...
Another apology required. Why can't Labour say sorry?
Yeah, well, Roy, if you have been left disadvantaged by this, obviously, you know, I regret that greatly. And, you know, these are the kinds of things that where people feel aggrieved, it is important either to explain or to apologise.
And do you think enough apologies were made in the campaign by Labour? Because it is suggested that, rightly or wrongly, the electorate feels you needed to say, particularly Mr Balls, Ed Balls, the former Shadow Chancellor, he needed to say sorry.
Well, the central question of the election in relation to the economy became the question, did we spend too much in government? And the fragility of the economy showed that we did spend too much in government. And in fact, I can remember, Nick, there was quite a debate, 2005-2006, about having a further comprehensive spending review to review forward levels of spending. And Gordon, as the Chancellor then, was absolutely opposed to this. And of course, his cooperation would have been essential. And, you know, I'm not blaming him, but I'm saying it wasn't something that passed without anybody thinking about it. And we were far too reliant on the financial and business sector, particular impact on London. And so when the tax revenues from those high earners in the financial sector stopped coming in, our economy was in great difficulty.
If in London, lastly, Tessa Jowell, where, of course, you will be standing as a Labour candidate, if in London more people are coming to Labour and indeed you had an increase in your vote, and across London more people voted for Labour, so if more people are joining Labour, that's going to help your rival colleague for the mayorship, Sadiq Khan, isn't it?
Well, I think it's good for Labour if more people join Labour and more people support Labour. We will shortly be...
But he might vacuum up all those new members, might he not?
Well, let's see. Let's see. This is a contest. And I have my case to make. He has his case to make. Diane Abbott has her case to make. David Lammy has his case to make. Christian Woolmar has his case to make. That's the point of a selection campaign.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Home Secretary Theresa May has written in The Times today, and she says that economic migrants rescued from the Med should be forcibly returned. It's stepping up Britain's opposition to an EU plan to take in tens of thousands of refugees. In a head-on confrontation with Brussels, the Home Secretary has argued a quota obliging European states to take a greater share of migrants simply encourages those at the mercy of evil, her word, people traffickers. I'll quote from her article. I disagree with the suggestion by the EU that no migrants intercepted at sea should be sent back against their will. Such an approach would only act as an increased pull factor across the Mediterranean and encourage more people to put their lives at risk. Official figures released yesterday show that Britain gave asylum to more applicants than 17 other EU states put together last year. This has prompted Mrs. May's criticism of the failure to do more for those escaping persecution. Now, despite receiving a relatively modest number of applications, Britain gave asylum to 14,065 people, putting us fifth after some other countries. What's the country that gave the most? I'll tell you that a little bit later and the numbers involved. Is this approach, though, that Theresa May is outlining right, would you say? Zoe Gardner is from the charity Asylum Aid, joins me now. What do you make of what the Home Secretary is saying? Good morning.
Good morning. I think that what the Home Secretary is saying is misrepresenting the EU position. It's simply not true that the EU does not return economic migrants entering the territory by illegal means. Actually, what the EU position is that these people must be allowed to have access to a fair asylum determination procedure. So they must have the chance to make their claim for protection in case they are, for example, Syrian, as many of them are, and would be at serious risk if returned. So that is what international law states, and that is the EU position. And Theresa May is attempting to characterise the EU position as one of just let anybody who comes stay, which is absolutely false.
So how many are returned by the EU then?
I couldn't tell you the exact number right now, but the majority of asylum claims across the EU are rejected, and the people then enter into return procedures. So in the UK, I can tell you that it's roughly two-thirds of asylum applications are rejected in the first instance. I would add that another third of those rejections are then overturned on appeal. So our decision-making process is slow, and it is not making good decisions in the first instance. So we need to be thinking about that. We need to be thinking about fair asylum procedures to assess the claims of the people coming in a fair and timely manner.
But how many... I mean, I know it's impossible to boil it down, but obviously a lot of these people are going to be economic migrants. They're not asylum seekers, are they?
Well, actually, the figures show that about a third of the people who have crossed the Mediterranean so far this year are from Syria. So the likelihood is that they are certainly refugees. Others are coming from, the highest numbers are coming from Eritrea, Somalia, Sudan. These are all countries that produce refugees that have people in desperate need of our protection from persecution. But let me just add, even if some of the people do come from situations where all they're fleeing, and I put that in inverted commas, just extreme poverty, and they are not entitled to protection under international law. What they are entitled to is a fair chance to be received, treated with dignity, and to make their case. And that is under British law, under European law, and under international law, they have that right. And summary returns have been explicitly condemned by the European Court of Human Rights.
But all that's going to happen is ultimately half of Africa might come here then.
Well, that's absolutely not the reality of what's
happening.
How do
you know?
I think we... Well, I know because we see the numbers. The overwhelming majority of refugees...
But you'll be aware that there's a 30-fold increase in the number of people... You'll be aware there's a 30-fold increase in the number of people who've perished trying to cross the Mediterranean just this year.
That's
a 30-fold...
because of the global security situation at present is such that more people than at any point since the Second World War are displaced by conflict. Libya, for example, is absolutely in turmoil, which is forcing more people to try to flee for their lives. What we've seen is...
But many of them are economic migrants. Why should Britain afford...
I don't think that people fleeing ISIS, public executions, torture, public hangings, public whippings...
So effectively, the whole of Libya can come and live here, can they, or the whole of Syria?
Let's talk about the facts here. The whole of Libya or the whole of Syria are manifestly not trying to come here. A few thousand people are, and as the richest nation in the world, it is...
We're not the richest nation in the world.
As the richest region in the world, we are allowing these people to die on our shores, and it is horrible.
Well, they're not our shores, are they? Oh, you mean Europe? I'm sorry, I thought you meant Britain. I'm sorry. Europe.
Yes.
Sorry, I meant Britain.
The world is allowing it.
But lastly, there will be people listening to you, Zoe. There will be people listening, particularly in inner city areas, in London, in Birmingham, in Leicester, and big cities saying we simply don't have room in our schools, in our hospitals, and indeed on our houses. We have not got room. How would you respond to that?
I would respond that we're talking about a few thousand people. You yourself said that 14,000-odd people were granted refugee status in the UK last year. These are completely manageable numbers. It's blown out of all proportion because people are tying this in with the wider immigration debate. But the asylum seekers and refugees make up a tiny percentage, about 3 or 4% of immigration to this country.
All right, Zoe Gardner, thank you. You're from Asylum Aid. Listening, Dr. Emma Carmel, senior lecturer at the University of Bath, who's researched into EU policy on migration matters, joins me now. What advice would you give to the Home Secretary, Theresa May? Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. Well, it's not my job to give our newly elected Home Secretary advice about how to negotiate with the EU. I see that she's already started that process by her intervention in the Times this morning.
Yes.
What's very interesting about the development that's going on at in terms of EU policy making is I do agree with your previous speaker that there seems to be some misrepresentation of the current situation, of the actual current law in the EU, and in fact of the UK's position in relation to the EU law on policy on migration. So the Theresa May this morning is arguing that the UK will oppose any mandatory resettlement programme that seems to, we don't know yet, but it seems to be on the cards. But she's not the only one. And a lot of member states in the EU will oppose a mandatory resettlement programme because it would change the relationship between the European Union and an individual member state. So individual member states want to keep charge of their own migration policy, and therefore they will probably, many of them, will be opposing a mandatory resettlement. There'll be a big divide between Italy, Greece, Spain, Germany and Sweden,
right,
all of whom are either receiving the migrants when they first land or taking refugees when they've been granted refugee status, and a number of other member states, including the UK, who don't want to take on any more refugees that don't land directly in their own countries. And that's really what the argument in the EU is going to be.
So how big a split could this be within the EU, would you say, Doctor?
Well, migration is a very hot topic and a highly contentious one, not only in the UK, but right across Europe, so within individual European countries and in relation to the EU. And that goes across this question of refugee and asylum seeking to the question of free movement. The UK is not alone in really seeing free movement as something of a problem in the European Union at the moment. And so this is just another flashpoint, another point at which these issues will be raised. And it's really about trying to negotiate the relationship between a generalised European responsibility for the issue of migration and the responsibilities of individual member states. And there's a lot of contention about that.
And lastly, when the Home Secretary says she believes these people should be returned to their native countries, do you, in all practical terms, do you actually see that? How likely is that would to happen?
Well, as your previous caller said, EU policy is very clear about this. This is related to international law and European law and national law. Every person arriving, if they want to make a claim for asylum, has the right to do so and the right to be heard, to have their case heard in a timely and thorough manner. And when that's not heard, then the country involved, where they've landed and has decided they don't have a right to refugee, has a right to return them, and the EU, so together...
And you think that will happen? You're confident that...
Well, at the moment it does happen, and then the current 10-point plan suggests that the European Union is going to step up the resources to give to member states, to redistribute to member states, to make that more possible, more and easier, so providing resources for that speedy return.
Doctor, thank you. Dr. Emma Carmel, you're a senior lecturer at the University of Bath. So we pluck them out the med, we listen to their case or their cause, and then we send them home. Is that right? And indeed, how likely is it? Plus the three runaway teenage schoolgirls, the runaway jihadi brides, as they were known. Nothing bridal about what they were forced to get up to, I would suggest. They're on the run again, this time from ISIS or ISIL. What are their chances? Emma Al-Badawi, PhD researcher at the University of Exeter's Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies. I want to talk to you about that war on hate, but first off, these runaway jihadi brides would appear, Emma Al-Badawi, to be on the run again. What chances that they can get out of the ISIL-held areas?
Well, it doesn't sound like it will necessarily be a success. By the sounds of it, they've engaged all of their checkpoints to look out for those girls. And it's difficult to tell, really. It's not easy to get in, but I can't imagine it will be very easy to get out either.
What is the reality of a life as what the media like to describe a jihadi bride?
Well, the term itself is a little bit misleading. It's a media term. It's not officially used. But it's certainly accurate in terms of the bride. The information that seems to come out is that the girls will need to be prepared if they travel to ISIS-held territory to get married to men. It's not really an environment for single women. But in terms of the jihadi and the emphasis on jihadi, I think that's a little bit inaccurate. There is no evidence that we've had so far to suggest that the girls are engaging in military warfare or frontline activity. The message is really very much that they're sort of participating in traveling, in working with as a mother, as a state building capacity, building up a generation of new ISIS troops.
Is the attraction greater, lesser, or roughly the same as it was some months ago, in your view?
Again, I mean, it was from in the last month, I don't think it's necessarily changed, but the message doesn't seem to be that ISIS is as much a success as it was, say, 3 or 4 months ago. They're losing a lot of territory, and they've gone sort of quiet in terms of propaganda, and they've been facing a lot of recent defeats. The success factor is really important for ISIS's propaganda. And that will inevitably affect how popular they are to people abroad in the UK as well. But the extremist threat is still there, and there is still the sense of radicalisation among our young people, both in the UK and across the globe. And so that threat is still always going to be there for quite some time until we really start to address it.
If ISIL are successful in tracking down these young women, what fate awaits them?
Again, it's difficult for someone like me to really know the answer to that question. The understanding is that they're trying to contain the information that comes out, and letting these girls loose back home would be a huge mistake for ISIS's containment strategy in terms of being able to control centrally what the information that comes out of ISIS territory is. It would be a huge weakness on ISIS if they managed to lose that control of that information. And so I can't see them taking it lightly that these girls would want to leave.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Can a relationship and marriage survive an affair? Sally Burko has given an interview to the papers in which she's talked about her troubled marriage to Commons Speaker John Burko amid claims she had an affair with his cousin. She said, "John and I have had a difficult marriage for a long time, primarily because we're living in Parliament. I hate it there. My husband is a good man. I can't tell you how awful it is living in Parliament. I don't want to go back. I wouldn't at all blame him if he thinks, right, I've had enough. She's embarrassed me enough. He's a good man. He's sucked it up enough in some respects. I'm saying he's a great dad and a great speaker. Am I a good wife?" asked Sally Burko. She answers her own question. "I'm a terrible wife, and I always have been. If I was John, I wouldn't put up with me. I'm not even going to say that he'll take me back." Now, Mrs. Burko has been accused of starting an affair with lawyer Alan Burko while her husband was away on the election campaign trail. There are other reports that suggest the relationship has been going on for subsequently quite a lot longer than that. She allegedly moved him into the couple's £1.2 million home in Battersea in southwest London. His wife, that is Alan Burko's wife, has confirmed the affair. And has spoken quite candidly of what she thinks of Sally Burko, and I can't read much of that too, as you can imagine. And so round it goes. The two men involved, Alan Burko and his cousin John Burko, have yet to comment. The two women, certainly Sally Burko, are not keeping their mouths shut about this. Well, the rights, wrongs and the veracity, I have no idea. In truth, there's probably only two or three people who know the reality of what's gone on there. Apparently it started because he was helping her have an understanding of fine wine. I've heard it called many things. I've never heard it called that before. Another glass of Malbec, dear. Oh, thank you very much indeed. That's a lovely Beaujolais. Any chance of a Vouvray? So, is the heart of this is whether a marriage or a relationship can survive this sort of infidelity. Let's turn to a couple of excerpts from pointers. Professor Eric Anderson is a sociologist at the University of Winchester. He's also written The Monogamy Gap, Men, Love and the Reality of Cheating. Professor, what is the reality of cheating? Good morning.
Good morning to you. Well, the reality of cheating is it is much more common than we even believe it is, particularly amongst men, but not just amongst men. In the modern age, it's more the norm than an oddity.
Why is that?
Well, quite simply, it's because we're not biologically designed, particularly males, for long-term monogamy. We grow satiated with sex with the same person. We desire sex with somebody else. This is probably a deep-seated biological factor at play. And so we're tricked into monogamy because the sex at the beginning is so fantastic and wonderful, and we're told by society that if we love a partner, we will only want sex and only have sex with them. But in time, we begin to realize that, that's not so true. The sex with our partners, the longest sexological finding is that sex amongst married couples decreases, and it decreases dramatically, and research shows that it's decreasing increasingly so as the decades progress.
So it's decreasing increasingly because we're becoming less and less content with our lives?
Well, probably because we're having sex earlier, we're having more sex earlier. Sex used to be that, for example, a couple would get together and they would discover things sexually in bed. Well, now, by the age of 15, everybody knows everything that there is to know. They run through the panoply of tricks much earlier. They have much more sex, and there's no longer marriage and all that. So our sexual lives become habituated much quicker than they've ever been.
I see. Now, do you have any idea of a gender breakdown? That is to say, men are 3 times more likely to have a relationship, 6 times more likely, 10 times more likely. What might it be?
The statistics on this are truly all over the place.
All right.
One research on millionaires showed that women have much higher rates of cheating than men. Millionaire women than millionaire men.
Millionaire women have a higher rate of cheating than millionaire men.
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
But because you're asking people to divulge a highly stigmatized activity, people aren't very truthful with you when they give the results. So it's really hard to say exactly what percentage of people cheat. We sort of think that at minimum 25% of couples have infidelity in them, and it's probably as high as 50 or perhaps 75%.
And lastly, we're talking, Professor, about whether a relationship, a marriage, can survive. What's your take on that?
Absolutely. Relationships are incredibly complex. The research shows that people can come together, usually in counseling afterwards, and have even better relationships.
Really? How does a relationship improve?
Because it's the catalyst that sparks the discussion that enables people to have their needs met in the relationship, that brings them to the table and to become more open with their emotions and their feelings and their desires. Sometimes it also leads to the beginning of an open relationship where people are allowed to have sex outside of the relationship or in terms of threesomes, and other times it leads to the allowment of polyamorous relationships where one can have more than one lover.
Goodness me, it's all going on. Professor, thank you. Eric Anderson, Professor in Sociology at the University of Winchester, author of The Monogamy Gap, Men, Love and the Reality of Cheating. Now, I'm coming to a counsellor, and it's not often you see counsellor in this context spelt like that, but let's get straight back to Downing Street, LBC's political editor Theo Usher. We've got another coming or a going. What's happening, Theo?
Yes, Nicky Morgan, the Education Secretary, has just arrived at Downing Street in a ministerial Jaguar. She's arrived here to meet David Cameron, and we're told she's, of course, going to be reappointed as Education Secretary. She had a beaming smile on her face. She stood to pose outside that famous door and waved to photographers and say she's doing very well. Another piece of news, a little bit of chat off the grapevine, that Boris Johnson is due here, the Mayor of London is due here within the next 10 to 15 minutes.
Oh, okay.
We're expecting him to take a job as a minister without portfolio. Of course, the thinking is that he can't juggle being Mayor of London with a big Whitehall's apartment, but he needs to sit in Cabinet. David Cameron wants him in Cabinet, and so he's going to take a job, a ministerial post, but just without a portfolio.
Theo, come back when you can. Thank you. My apologies to Christine Norbam, who's a councilor spokeswoman with Relate, the nation's largest provider of relationship support, joins me now. Is that true, then? A relationship can actually benefit in some way from an affair?
Yes, definitely. It's the number one reason, really, why people come to Relate, because an affair has happened. And certainly in our experience, we know that couples can come out of the other side of an affair stronger, communicating much better, and having a richer marriage. So, yes, affairs can be positive, but they can also be negative in that it may be a signpost, actually, the affair, that the relationship is over for one of the couple, probably the one who's had the affair, and that it's a catalyst for the actual breakdown of the relationship and eventual divorce or separation.
If a couple present themselves to relate, what is the first thing that you or one of your colleagues would say? I would imagine, and I wouldn't dream and I wouldn't be able to put words in your mouth, but everyone's got to be pretty candid with each other.
Oh, yeah, and if they can't be honest, actually, in the counselling, then usually you don't make much progress. So it's very important, as you say, Nick, to be open and honest and to engage with the process. And if, you know, you really have been unhappy in the marriage, and it may be that the one who's had the affair is not necessarily the main reason why the relationship's broken down. It may be the other one who has perhaps, say, a bereavement has occurred which has knocked them for six. And so they've withdrawn from the relationship. And then the other one goes off and has an affair because they've lost the intimacy, the closeness that they had with the partner who's grieving. And it may be that it's always been like that in the relationship. It's been a bit dysfunctional. They haven't actually been able to pull together to work collaboratively. Mm. And so it's a signal or a catalyst for a divorce or a separation. But that could be achieved in counselling. And very often when people come to counselling when it's the end of a relationship because an affair's happened, if they understand what's happening then they don't, and why it's occurred, then they don't go on to repeat it in another relationship because they've learned more about themselves.
Lastly, who's more likely to be forgiving, a fella or a woman?
I don't know. As your Professor Eric Anderson just said, stats are all over the place. But in my experience, I've been a counsellor with couples for over 20 years now. I couldn't say definitely more men than women. But it happens a lot. Affairs are increasing, actually. And I think it's a sort of symptom of where we are in society. Maybe long working hours, couples aren't together enough. And maybe, you know, they all need to be really cool with the idea of coming along to counselling as soon as there's an inkling of something wrong. Don't let it fester. Address it and come along to relate or to any of the counsellors who work across the country to help them.
Thank you for that. Christine Northam is a counsellor and spokeswoman for Relate, the nation's largest provider of relationship support. Quick word from Bill in Woolwich on this. Bill, what's your view?
Oh, good morning.
Yes, sir.
Quite shocked. The professor is basically right. In affairs, men seem to lie, but women lie better.
How do you know this, Bill?
Through experience.
I'm sorry, Bill.
No, don't be sorry about it.
Oh, I'm delighted for you, Bill.
Well, good for you, because I'm quite thrilled by the aspect of it.
Are you? Bill, can I... This was your ex-wife, was it, Bill?
No, not in this particular... This is since she divorced me.
Oh, right.
And prior to getting married anyway, but we won't go into that. And the older woman is a good teacher. won't go too deeply into these things.
No, I think probably not,
this
Bill.
Time in the morning.
No, how old, by the way?
Into school,
Bill's 90. Yep, OK. Oh, you heard that, did you, Bill? Yeah. Oh, the laughs we've had down the years. But has it all sorted itself out now, Bill? Your little ménage à quatre? Or is it a Renault 5?
I don't think we better go too
deeply. No, we're not going too deeply into anything, are we, Bill?
But the professor was basically right. I must admit, he's got his facts pretty good.
All right, sir. Always good speaking with you. Look after yourself. And that harrying down there. I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.